pertaining to the demigods in the higher planets. Sahasra, 1,000. Abdam, 1,000. It's not the verse. Sorry. Nishamya, after hearing. Tat, that. Vaktra, the speaker. Didrukshaya, just to find out who spoke. Dishaha, all sides. Vilokya, seeing. Tatra, there. Anyat, any other. Apashyamanaha, not to be found. Swadhishnyam, on his lotus seat. Asthaya, sit down. Vimrushya, thinking. Tat, it. Hitam, welfare. Tapasi, in penance. Upadishtaha, as he was instructed. Iva, in pursuance of. Adadhe, gave. Manaha, attention. Okay, good. Nishamyatadvaktra didrukshayadisho vilokya tatranyad apashyamanaha swadhishnyamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam tapasya upadishta ivadadhe manaha nishamyatadvaktra didrukshayadisho vilokya tatranyad apashyamanaha swadhishnyamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam tapasya upadishta ivadadhe manaha nishamya tadvaktra didrukshayadisho vilokya tatranyad apashyamanaha swadhishnyamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam Vimrushyataddhitam tapasya upadishta ivadadhe manaha Nishamyatadvaktradidrukshayadisho vilokyatatranyadapashyamanaha Swadhishnamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam Nishamyatadvaktra didrukshayadisho Vilokyatatranyadapashyamanaha Vishnamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam tapasya upadishta nishamya tadvaktra didrukshayadisho Vishnamasthaya vimrushyataddhitam निशाम्य तद्वत् प्रतिद्रुक्षयाति शो विलोक्य तत्रान्यदपश्यमानः स्वधिष्णमास्थाय मृष्य तद्विधम् Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. When he, referring to Brahmaji, when he heard the sound, he tried to find the speaker, searching on all sides. But when he was unable to find anyone besides himself, he thought it wise to sit down on his lotus seat firmly and give his attention to the execution of penance as he was instructed. To purport to achieve success in life, one should follow the example of Lord Brahma, the first living creature in the beginning of creation. After being initiated by the Supreme Lord to execute tapasya, he was fixed in his determination to do it. And although he could not find anyone besides himself, he could rightly understand that the sound was transmitted by the Lord himself. Brahma was the only living being at that time because there was no other creation and none could be found there except himself. In the beginning of the first canto, in the first chapter, first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, it has already been mentioned that Brahma was initiated by the Lord from within. The Lord is within every living entity as a super soul, and he initiated Brahma because Brahma was willing to receive the initiation. The Lord can similarly initiate everyone who is inclined to have it. We'll focus on this theme. It's a long purport, so we'll stop here. ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमा ओम विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी इति नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देश तारिणे वांचाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवास आदि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 रामा राम राम हरे 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 कृष्णा. Today morning, we are discussing one of the most formative incidents in the Srimad Bhagavatam, where we have Brahmaji responding to the Lord's call by sitting in meditation. So, I'll speak today on the broad topic of how spiritual awakening occurs. We can look at this from our own lives. Many of us are involved in trying to get others to come to bhakti. So why is it that some people, they just are so ripe and ready for receiving spirituality, and they respond so enthusiastically? And why is it that for some others, it just doesn't happen? So, broadly speaking, there is some combination in spiritual awakening of the mystical and the rational. So, something mysterious happens which makes people look upward. Look beyond the normal way of living. And in this case, in the case of Brahmaji, it is the sound tapa, tapa. That, as he is saying, apashyamanah, he is looking around and there is no explanation. There is no one over here who could have spoken this. So there is something mysterious that happens, something mystical, something strange, something. Prabhupada didn't like the word mystical so much. He often used it. Mystical is misty. So we could say transcendental, divine, something beyond. So, and then there is a rational component to it. So the rational component is here that he heard and he said, okay, I can't figure out what to do. There is some direction coming. I don't know from where that direction is coming, but that seems to be the sensible thing to do. So as far as possible, it's only this rational component that is accessible or analyzable for us. The transcendental component, it's just the mystical component, is the magic of Krishna working. And that's why, you know, we cannot have devotees produced like a factory line. Sometimes some people do that. You know, okay, you speak this message and people will be convinced. And you do this and they will come to, you take them to yatra, they will take to this, come to this many rounds. Now sometimes it can happen. But there has to be some deep internal awakening that occurs with it. So the mystical and the rational. When sociologists, especially those who study sociology of religion or psychology of religion, they try to analyze why do religions demographics go up or why do certain religions spread or certain religion go down, they can only analyze the rational aspect of it. And there is value in that, no doubt. So this dynamic of the mystical and the rational, it's good to try to get a sense of the mystical, but it's important to focus on the rational because that's what is objectively observable. The mystical is what a person has experienced inside them. We'll try to understand that. And I'll focus on an acronym, FAR. How far does a person go in their spiritual journey? Some people, when you present spirituality, they go far away. They just say that, I don't want anything to do with this. And some people go a little distance and they say, okay, that's enough. I was talking with recently, when I've been traveling abroad, I've been trying to reconnect with my school and college friends. Now they are settled all over the world in various places. So when I meet them, some of them were also, they had started their spirituality at that with me in college. And then one of them said, you know, yeah, I believe in soul, I believe in God, I believe in reincarnation. And he said, my spirituality is a project for my next lifetime. So he said, I did something, yeah, it's valuable, but it's not something for me right now. So why do different people go different distances? So he'll try to look at three factors to illustrate, to analyze this. So the first is the common experience of everyone in life, that is frustration. See, now the way I'm going to depict this is, there is a human journey going on. We are in the human world. And mostly people want to go ahead in the human journey. Okay, where I am, maybe I get more wealth, I get more fame. Nowadays that means I get more Instagram followers. You know, I want to become an influencer. So there is a straight path. Now within the straight path, there can be many varieties. So I may want to become an engineer, somebody want to become a doctor, this. But all of them are in the same straight dimension. Most people seek growth within the material dimension. Now, there are a few who start seeking growth in toward the spiritual dimension. So, Krishna himself says these are manushyanam sahasreshu. There are very, very few. So, what prompts them to do that? So, we'll talk about two factors. One which is external and negative, one which is external and positive, and one which is internal, rising from within, which is, of course, you can correct with transcendental. So the negative is frustration. So everybody experiences frustration in life in some way or the other, some time or the other. And for most people, frustration with the material, that is what opens them to the possibility of the spiritual. Now, frustration can go over a wide range. It can just be a dissatisfaction that, oh, you know, I had this dream and I achieved this. I wanted to get this degree. I want to get this kind of house. I wanted to be in this kind of relationship. And I've got that. And it's not fulfilling. So frustration, dissatisfaction is basically, often I'm talking specifically desires fulfilled, at least some desires fulfilled, heart not fulfilled. So, okay, is there any problem? Thanks for dose of mercy. So this is where people, it's not that there is something radically wrong in their lives, but there is something missing in my life. And that missing makes them look for something more. And majority of the people who turn towards spirituality are from this demographic. We'll see 20, 25 years ago, not many Indians were interested in spirituality. Religion was always a part of it, but that was more a cultural thing. But now, as say India has risen to a certain level of prosperity, along with prosperity, a certain set of problems have come. Because when there is poverty, the focus generally goes in the straight direction. I want to get money. Now, Indians are, at least a significant part of Indians, are quite rich. The middle class is burgeoning, some have gone to the upper middle class. And then you feel, hey, there has to be something more in life. And that's why people start exploring spirituality. So it could be dissatisfaction. But it can also be devastation. Devastation could be because of bereavement. Bereavement means somebody loses a loved one. It could be because of heartbreak. An important relationship just completely breaks apart. That people use the word break up, but mostly there is no up, it's only break down. So, now beyond that, there could be also some fatal diagnosis that maybe a fatal or at least a lethal diagnosis that you're going to die or you have a serious disease. So basically, the normal fabric of reality that we have built around ourselves just crumbles. Whatever gave meaning to our life, it's just gone completely. So at that time, any of these frustrations can make a person look for something more. So artho, artharthi. These are categories in that 7.14. So this is broadly related with 7.14. Now, jigyasu also, there is some dissatisfaction in curiosity. There could be hundreds of things a person could be curious about. Why would that person be curious about spirituality? There's something dissatisfied, something missing in life. So broadly, frustration is often the starting point for people when they embark on their spiritual journey. Now, Srila Prabhupada, in one lecture which he gave to the when the Rath Yatra was going on, so a lot of people from the counterculture, some of whom were hippies, had assembled over there. And Prabhupada in the lecture says that, in your society, you are not appreciated very much. You are considered frustrated people. He says, I appreciate you. He says, human life is meant to be frustrated. And he says, Athato Brahma Jigyasa. That it is when we are frustrated with the material that we will inquire about the spiritual. Now, this is a remarkable insight in his commentary to the Vedanta Sutra, Ramanujacharya, in his Sri Bhashya. Is almost 100-page commentary on just the first verse, Athato Brahma Jigyasa. Now, when Prabhupada presents Athato Brahma Jigyasa, it's more like a call. We should inquire about spirituality. So that Athato Brahma Jigyasa, that particular verse can be seen in two different ways. Prabhupada's reading is more that it is a instruction, it is a call. Now that we have got human life, we should inquire about the ultimate reality. This is how Srila Prabhupada sees it. Ramanujacharya, he sees it as an inclination. Now that's not the only way he sees this. But he says that some people have that inclination for Brahma Jigyasa and many don't. So why do these people have it? And he gives various factors of analysis. His analysis is something similar to what Krishna Chikritakur does in Madhurya Kadampani about what attracts people to Krishna. How do people come to bhakti? Now coming to bhakti is a more specific form of Brahma Jigyasa. Brahma Jigyasa is a broad spiritual inquiry. But the point is, there's an elaborate analysis over there. So Brahma Jigyasa, that awakening of Brahma Jigyasa is actually a mystery. It's not so easy for that to happen. But frustration is a common denominator to some degree. As I said, it could be dissatisfaction, it could be devastation. And this is where one of the challenges comes up for us, for our movement, when we try to do outreach in the West, that bhakti is for Western people, or in general for non-Indians, bhakti is actually extremely expensive. What do you mean by expensive? Expensive not in terms of money, but in terms of culture and conception. See, generally when a person is frustrated, they will seek relief from the frustration by going toward a familiar source of relief. So if the mainstream culture in the West is Christianity, then people may have gone to church sometimes in their childhood, occasionally. And when they are frustrated, the first place they will go to is the church. Or if they are born a Jew family, they will go towards a synagogue. So in India, when a person is dissatisfied, when a person is looking for something bigger in life, naturally they will gravitate towards a temple. Because that's the majority religion over here. That's the broader culture. So now, for somebody, when life becomes uncomfortable, normally, when there's discomfort, we go towards the familiar, not the unfamiliar. This is much easier. So now, bhakti, it's culturally unfamiliar for many people. It's culturally expensive. Why culturally expensive? Okay, you have to change your dress completely. You have to eat a different kind of food. You have to wear a different kind of marks. And mostly when people come to explore something spiritual, there's some curiosity that it might be there. But because there's so much cultural change that is to be made, so people have a lot of cultural curiosity. See, curiosity does not cost much. But the leap from cultural curiosity to cultural commitment costs a lot. And that is difficult. Like anybody can come and dance in a kirtan and they enjoy it. Nowadays people may like to take a selfie. Oh, I danced in a kirtan. Yeah, Hare Krishna kirtan. But what happens for many of us is, if somebody is enthusiastic dancing in kirtan, oh, and they say, I had such a great experience. Okay, tomorrow morning you can come for Mangalarti at 4:30. Now, that is too big a cultural commitment for them. And then not only come tomorrow, come every day. Well, so, what happens? It's not just the specifics of waking up in the morning, but the broad culture. It is difficult. I was in Australia in a farm, and there was one lady who had come there, an Australian lady, sir. She saw me, we started talking. Well, she said, I come for the first time. And she said, I have a question. I said, yes. He says, when you people blow this conch, why does everyone kiss the floor? Why does everyone kiss the floor? Now, from their perspective, it's such a bizarre practice. So there was one young man, he was telling me that when he came to a temple for the first time, you know, his girlfriend brought him to the temple. And he said he came in the same car, but when I came to the temple, we were told to sit separately. And he said, I was all alone over there, surrounded by Indians, and I couldn't make head or tail of what was happening. So he said, after that, he said, I'm never going to come here. Then, when he was later on introduced to a Western Outreach Center, where such gender boundaries were not so rigidly imposed, it was culturally relatively more comfortable for him. So the point is that, in the West, even churches, men and women sit together. So there is a certain amount of cultural expense, which is difficult. So when somebody is frustrated, you tell them to do something which is already more difficult for them. So culturally, even conceptually, what is going on over here? Curiosity is one thing, but commitment is a different thing. Now, of course, there are people who will be attracted, because generally, there are politically people on the left and people on the right. So people on the right, those are conservatives, they seek order. And people on the left, naturally, this is almost like there people are different, people are neurologically wired differently. So people who are on the left, they seek to disrupt order. So generally, people in the West who, when they want to explore something spiritual, they come to us, they are mostly left-oriented. And people in India who come to spirituality, they are right-oriented. And that's why you'll see people who are left-oriented, they will be much more sympathetic, even if they're in their religious practices or religious sympathies, towards the minority religion. Now, if you see the left values and the Islamic values, they're radically different. Left wants equality. Islam has the highest hierarchy among all religions, rigid hierarchies of every kind, gender and others. And yet there is this almost inexplicable nexus between the left and Islam. Why? Because in places where Islam is in minority, the people with leftist tendencies, their idea is disrupt the existing order. So even when they are in distress, when they seek relief, their relief will not be going toward the tradition, but disrupting the tradition. So yes, people can come amidst frustration through the minority path also. So we are the minority in the West. That's why people with the leftist inclination come to bhakti. And that's why when I was in America for 3 months, there's so many American devotees repeatedly were asking me this question. He said, I never thought, not older devotees, but younger devotees, I never thought I would see this day, he said. I thought I'm practicing Indian spirituality, but you know what kind of country is India that you build a temple after destroying a mosque, and then the whole country celebrates that. And the prime minister of the country goes and celebrates that. You know, do I really want to belong to an intolerant religion like this? Now you go backward and say, it's not just a mosque. The temple was destroyed by building a temple was built by destroying a mosque. The mosque was built by destroying a temple. Now that is true, but you know what happens in recent history is what we should be accountable for. What happened in distant history, don't bother about it. It's a fractured view, but the leftist view is there's a lot of sympathy for Islam. And this happens within the devotee community also. Of course, if people come to India and experience that what the myth of intolerance as is portrayed in New York Times and Guardian as compared to what is the reality is very different. But the point I'm making is that in frustration, different people go in different directions. So frustration is the first thing that prompts people. And after that, I've hinted a second point. The acronym I was going to discuss was FAR. A is association. So, essentially, everybody follows someone or the other. So, for somebody to take to a spiritual path, they need to find someone who, to use Western language, who is cooler than the person whom they were following before. So, that could be somebody who is interested in music. And they find somebody, hey, this person is so good at music. They like to hear speeches, and this person is a great speaker. They like to feel comforted and welcomed, and they love hospitality and belonging. And they find somebody who is very attentive and caring. And that's what attracts them. So, what in association will attract whom? That will vary from person to person. But what kind of people a person meets, that is vital. So association is the positive influence. See, many people become frustrated, but very few among frustrated people actually turn towards spirituality because they don't meet the right association. And in fact, if they meet the wrong association, they not only go away, they often become anti also. I was in Texas, and Texas is part of the Bible Belt in America, where there's a lot of evangelical religion. You know, for we in India, for us, America is Hollywood and materialism. But actually, in the Western world, America is the most religious country as compared to Russia, as compared to France or UK or Australia or New Zealand or any of Canada for that matter. America is the most religious country. In fact, I was in New Zealand and I was talking, they were talking with a Kiwi person. He said, where all do you travel? He said, travel to America. Oh, those are those religious nuts who elected Trump. So they treat America to be a country of religious nuts. So America is almost like two countries. The liberal parts, the coastal parts are very liberal. The central and the southern parts are quite conservative and religious. Anyway, so the point is that America is quite a religious country. And so in Texas, I was going for a program and there was a school, there was a car and the car had a bumper sticker. And it said, "Oh God, please save me from your preachers." Please save me from your preachers. The idea was that if the preachers are holier than thou, if the preachers are condescending, the preachers are saying, "You're going to go to hell if you don't follow me," then people say, I don't care for such preachers. In fact, that has decreased, and sociologists say that it is because of the influence of bhakti spirituality and the vision of a God of love that came from India, that Christians have started focusing less on the Old Testament God who sends people to hell and more on Jesus as an embodiment of unconditional love. So their idea of God as an embodiment of love, that is now the focus of the churches which are becoming popular. And to some extent, that's the influence of Indic spirituality. But the point is, what kind of association a person gets, that shapes their spiritual search a lot. And that's where our responsibility comes in. Srila Prabhupada gave different answers to this question at different times. At one time, Prabhupada was asked that, what will determine how much Krishna consciousness spreads? And Prabhupada said, it depends on the preachers. It depends on how and how much they preach. So, association is a key factor. And it's not just association, it is association that can attract and inspire people. Just having a community of priests or preachers alone is not enough. They need to have that capacity, that magnetism. At least, if not the magnetism, at least the intelligence to conduct themselves in a way that attracts others to Krishna. That's why, if you see in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in 12.13 to 20, when Krishna gives the qualities that endear a devotee to him, there it's interesting, the qualities that Krishna is describing are not devotional qualities. In the sense that they are not about devotional activities. Krishna does not say a devotee who wakes up and comes for Mangalarti is dear to me. A devotee who chants 16 rounds is dear to me. A devotee who fasts on Ekadashi is dear to me. A devotee who has a Nirjala Ekadashi is dear to me. Krishna doesn't say any of these things. All the qualities Krishna mentions are behavioral qualities. Adveshta sarva bhutana maitra karuna evacha. One who is friendly, one who is compassionate, one who is composed. Yasman no dvijate loko, lokan no dvijate chaya. One who does not agitate others and one who is not agitated by others. In fact, you know, when you read the Bhagavad Gita again and again, each time it's like you feel as if you never read the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, when I started doing Western outreach and one devotee showed me this verse, I couldn't believe actually this verse was in the Gita. So, why was it? Because in many ways, the way I grew up or the way I was trained, I thought the definition of a preacher is one who agitates others and one who is agitated by others. The idea is, you should be agitated. So many people are living materialistically, sinfully. You should be agitated. You should feel angry and agitated how people are living. And what is preaching if not agitating others? People are living comfortably, you have to agitate others. Well, there is some truth to that. But most people, when they seek spirituality, they want something calming and uplifting. So generally, those who are agitated and who agitate others, they will also attract followers. But those followers are who become extremists and fanatics. So every religious demographic, it's not that fanatics are born. Nobody is born with a label fanatic. Just because somebody is born in a particular religion, they don't become fanatic. It is people whose definition of preaching is the opposite of what Krishna is saying. That not one. So what does it mean? Don't be agitated by others and don't agitate others. That means we behave in a way. Everybody is disturbed in the world. And we want to show people the path to becoming more peaceful. To finding a higher purpose and meaning in their lives. And those who have the opposite qualities, they can also be devotees. See, Krishna doesn't reject those who do not manifest these behavioral qualities. But what happens is, those devotees who do not have these behavioral qualities, they are liabilities for Krishna. Like a parent accepts all children. Now a child might be very mischievous, irresponsible. The parent will not reject the child. But the parent cannot entrust anything to that child. Isn't it? So like that, devotees who don't have broadly sattvic qualities, they are also accepted by Krishna. Apichet sudaracharo bhajate mamananya bhak Krishna says. That even those who do sinful activities, he considers them devotees. But the problem is, if these behavioral qualities, they are present and they are absent. Now, devotees can have both. So those when they are absent, those devotees are liabilities for Krishna and for Krishna's mission. Where people speak harshly, people speak inappropriately, and then they create a mess which others have to clean up. I was talking with one of our devotees who is in mediation, and he was telling me that samsara davana lidhaloka. He said that, you know, we are meant to extinguish the forest fires of material existence, but he says most of our energy is going in extinguishing the forest fires that we ourselves have lit. That means somebody among us has only lit that. So that happens when devotees somehow lack these behavioral qualities. So this is when they are present, then such devotees are assets for Krishna. And that's why when Srila Prabhupada was asked, how do we know your followers? He didn't say that they follow four regulative principles, they chant 16 rounds. Yeah, that's true. This was a journalist asking him. It's definitely true. I'm in no way minimizing the importance of devotional activities and devotional qualities. I'm saying that in this particular context, if we are to be a part of those who can bring about spiritual awakening in others, then what is important? So Prabhupada said, my followers are perfect gentlemen and ladies. Prabhupada is echoing, using contemporary language, what Krishna is saying in 12, 13 to 20. So essentially, this is the mood of most people who are spiritual seekers. They say, don't tell me what you believe. Now, everybody can have what you believe and everybody can present it in their own way. Don't tell me what you believe. Show me how you behave. So it is our behavior that will primarily attract people. So now what we believe is undoubtedly important. But how we behave is much more important. So it's association that can attract people. And in many ways, the destruction or the fall of the Vedic tradition happened not just because there were so many invaders, but it was primarily because of the discriminatory caste system, where those in the higher caste, rather than showing people the way upward, started simply enjoying their privilege and the power that came from keeping people down. See, Bhagavatam also says that the downfall, the onset of Kali Yuga began because of a not some aggressor coming and destroying, but because of a Brahmana misusing his power. That is Sringi cursing Parikshit Maharaj. So the point is, association, how it functions, that plays a large role in how spiritual awakening occurs. And that brings me to the last part. What's the acronym we're discussing? R, yes. So R is reactivation. Now, reactivation can refer either to something which is intrinsic to the soul, that every person is a soul and every soul has spiritual longing, or it can refer to a previous life's practice. So now, what exactly is intrinsic to the soul? There is some debate among the Gaudiya theologians. Prabhupada took the position that love for Krishna is there within every living being, dormant. Now, there are other Gaudiyas who say that actually, love for Krishna is what is given by Guru. But the broad spiritual propensity is there, whatever be it. There is some capacity for spiritual awakening that is there intrinsic in everyone. And beyond that, if somebody has practiced spirituality previously, then that can be awakened. So Krishna talks about this in 6:43-45. Purva bhyasena tenaiva riyate yavashopi saha. It's a very beautiful phrase, Krishna says. Riyate. Riyate means is attracted. How avasha? Normally the word avasha is used in a negative sense. Like I am helpless against my conditionings. Or the Bhagavata also says that bhutva bhutva praliyate avasha. That again and again there is destruction that happens. But here the word avasha is used in the Bhagavad Gita in a positive sense. That it's almost as if without our conscious intention or control, we are just attracted towards spirituality. And you know how Krishna will attract, it's a great mystery. When we meet devotees, we generally ask the question, how you came to Krishna, how did you come to Krishna consciousness? Generally, if we are in the West, we are meeting people, they may not have yet come to Krishna consciousness, but they are on a spiritual journey. So we ask, how did your spiritual journey start off? So when I meet people, Americans, I talk with them, it's amazing how what that purva abhyas, you know, what will trigger an awakening? Now, if we consider the Bhagavatam itself, there is this spiritual awakening happening in Gajendra. And that what triggered it was, if you go back, frustration. Jajapya paramam japyam prak janmanyanu shikshitam. It is said that when he just couldn't overcome that crocodile and its grip, then at that time what he had remembered in the previous life he remembered. So basically in this acronym FAR, this frustration and association are the rational part. I said there's a rational and a mystical. So this reactivation, that is a mystical part. You know, what will actually trigger awakening? That is difficult to know. Now, the Bhagavatam is not exactly clear with respect to Gajendra's story that he remembered from the past. Now, is it that he had exactly offered the same prayer in the past life and he verbatim repeated the prayer? Well, that's unlikely because he also mentions that he is caught in a pash. He's caught in the, now he doesn't explicitly mention the crocodile, but he says, pash, I'm caught in a noose. So unless there was an identical incident in the previous life where he was caught in a pash, we could say he remembered the principle and then he articulated in his own words over here. So at least some part of his prayers is clearly contextual, where he says that, I don't mind dying right now. Jiji Vishayam. So he says, he doesn't mind dying. So basically, generally when this spiritual awakening occurs, it is not necessarily in terms of cognitive information. It's not that a person remembers something specific from a previous life. But a person who has practiced a lot of bhakti in their previous life, it's not that when they are born in the next life, the newborn baby will be chanting Hare Krishna instead of crying. No. But, like with respect to Mahaprabhu, he would, like a normal child, he would cry. But when kirtans were there, he would calm down. So, like that, there is some attraction that is there.
So I met one person who's a scholar of religion. He specializes in Hinduism with a focus on Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So I told him, you know, what attracted him, what started his spiritual journey. And he said that, I just fell in love with the Sanskrit script. That's interesting, the script. He said, when I read the Sanskrit script, he said, this seemed to be like mathematical symbols to me. You know, if you see how Sanskrit, right? It's like calligraphy or mathematical symbols. When I read the script, I said, I don't understand what the script is saying. And that's how we learned Sanskrit, and that's how we came to spirituality. So that reawakening, what it will be. For somebody else, it might be that they just feel a pull towards some festival. You know, the Rath Yatra is going on, the Kirtan is going on. Now, there could be one thing which is just a cultural curiosity, a casual curiosity. But some people just feel pulled towards it. Indradhanu Maharaj writes some stories in his Diary of Traveling Teacher, how, you know, there was this young girl. She saw the devotees and she told her parents, this is in Poland, which is a Catholic country. She said, I want to go to this festival. The parents were hardcore Catholics. No, I want to go. And they came there. And when she came there, it was like almost most people over there in the festival of India, especially women, they go to their favorite place is the gopi dots and the sari festival, sari stall. Where you put gopi dots on the face and henna on the hands. And but this small girl just went straight to the deities of Jagannath. And she's just beholding them. So this is Purvabhyasena Tenaiva Rhyate Yavashopisa. So which aspect of Krishna will cause awakening in whom? How and when? That we can't predict. And that is the mystical part. So when Prabhupada says in the prayers of Queen Kunti, that section, you know, we create a soothing atmosphere in the temple hall. We create an attractive ambience. And some element of that ambience will attract people. So which element it will be, we can't know. But some element will attract. And that's how the spiritual awakening occurs. I'll conclude with the last point. That the spiritual awakening is not just necessarily a one-time event. Where, okay, now this person has become a devotee. The spiritual awakening can also be an ongoing event. Because for us also at different times, you know, frustration may prompt us to become more serious about our relationship with Krishna. Sometimes some association will give us some inspiration. Maybe a devotee speaks a kind word, a devotee shares a flash of insight. Maybe a devotee has developed a particular skill or ability which just mesmerizes us. Feel, I want to do this also. Whatever it is. And something for us also. Because when you say the jiva jago, it's an incremental awakening from sleep. So we are all in the process of waking up. We can't say we all have already woken up. Yeah, certainly we can say we are more awakened than people who are just living materialistically. But it's a ongoing process. And we all, while we do our sadhana, it's important for us to do our sadhana, do our seva. But in many ways, this is the rational aspect of it. Now, this is what we are told and this is what we understand will bring about that spiritual awakening. But beyond our rational exercise, we have to be open to the mystical. Because every day we come for darshan, one day the darshan seems extraordinarily attractive. Now every day we do our chanting, some days maybe we feel, oh, it's like I don't want chanting to end, I want to chant more than 16 rounds. We feel some strength, we feel some connection. Other days we take out our beads and we see, you know, has somebody changed it from 108 to 1008 beads? This is just not ending. So we cannot have a mathematical pathway. You know, okay, you have a sadhana card every day, you have woken up at this time, you have done this much, you have this much, therefore you have advanced devotee. Well, yes, you know, we certainly have to do our part. I'm not devaluing diligence in doing our part. But we cannot reduce bhakti to the mere exercise of diligence on our part. Like the two fingers which were needed for Mother Yashoda to tie Krishna. So that one finger was our endeavor. So we use our rational intelligence to do what we understand will awaken us spiritually. At the same time, we have to be open to the fact that there is a mystical element to the mercy, the grace that will actually bring about that spiritual awakening. Sevon mukhehi jivhadav. That is the rational part. And spurtyadaha, that self-revelation, that self-manifestation, that spurti, that is the mystical part. And so bhakti, in that sense, throughout, is this blend of the rational and the mystical. So I'll summarize what I discussed today. Broadly, we're discussing the topic of how spiritual awakening occurs. Basically, we see Brahmaji's spiritual awakening, and I discuss broadly 3 points based on an acronym, FAR. So F was, what was it? Frustration. So frustration can range from just dissatisfaction to downright devastation. So now generally amid frustration, people seek relief mostly in the familiar. And that's why they will go towards the mainstream culture, the mainstream religion basically. Now of course a minority will seek relief in the unfamiliar, they are the rebellious people. So this is where mostly the right people will go. Those who will seek relief in the unfamiliar, they are seeking relief will be in the alternative. There, so these are the people on the left. But either way, frustration is one of the key factors that actually begins the spiritual journey. So basically, when we are discussing this, instead of going the straight path, when somebody starts looking upwards, that could be because of something negative and something positive. So the negative is the frustration, the positive is the association. And what bubbles up from within is the mystical. So A was association. So here we discussed how association, there can be varied elements within association, which a person may find cool, attractive, whatever it might be. But what we can, it might be the musical ability, it might be the behavioral skill, it might be intellectual, it might be cultural, whatever it may be. But broadly, what we can see is, for this to work, the devotees should have the behavioral aspect is much more important than the devotional aspect over here. Now, if somebody is very rigid in following the rules, but that makes them bitter towards those who don't follow the rules, then they will not be. The behavioral aspect means a person should be broadly sattvic. And then such people can be assets who attract people towards Krishna. The last part was this reactivation. That the activation can be from the soul's eternal nature or the previous life's practice. So either way, this activation has a mystical aspect to it. And these two is the rational, what we can do. And this reactivation is the mystical aspect that we wait for ourselves as well as for others. And this is almost, it's like avashaha. Avashaha means it's not so much helpless as it is beyond our control. It is beyond our control in a positive sense. So that spuratya, that spurti, that mercy, we all need to wait. So we follow the rules, but we also understand that bhakti is more than the rules. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Do we have time for maybe one question or comment? Yes, please.
Hare Krishna. As in the last point, it's mentioned that it is soul's intrinsic nature to take to bhakti. So when we hear in scripture that, you know, bhakti is beyond karma, so why there is need of, you know, initial sukruti or something to actually take to person to bhakti? Why can't person directly take to bhakti? Why there is initial push needed or some like previous practice, some practice is needed? If one directly comes in touch with bhakti, he should directly take to bhakti.
Yeah, that's the issue of debate, you know, that Nitya Siddha Krishna Prem Sadhya Kabunaye. So different Gaudiya scholars give translate that verse in different ways. So Prabhupada translated that as saying that it means that love for Krishna is dormant within everyone's heart. So, Prabhupada focuses on the Nitya Siddha. Other Gaudiya scholars focus on Sadhya Kabunai. They focus on that part. That is, it is not awakenable. So it is basically there are two ways of looking at it. And there's elaborate discussion and there's some way to reconcile it also. See, basically, with spirituality, you can use two words for it. One is dormant, the other is fertile. Fertile means, like, if you use it for a soil. Now, if we consider the soul to be like a fertile soil, the fertile soil, the soil has to be fertile for any harvest to happen. But no matter how fertile the soil is, unless some seed is planted, nothing is going to happen over there. And the seed comes externally. So now, that is what the metaphor is. Brahma and Brahmite, Kona Bhagyavana Jiu, Guru Krishna Prasade Pai, Bhakti Lata Beej. So one is, so the heart, the soul, whatever word you want to use it over here, here we can use them intelligently, is the heart like a fertile soil in which the guru has to plant the beach. And Prabhupada seems to take sometimes that tack. He says that everybody is unfortunate and we have to make them fortunate. So when we give Krishna Bhakti, that's when they become fortunate. Otherwise, that Bhagyavan, how do they become Bhagyavan? We have to make them Bhagyavan. But on the other hand, if say we consider it to be like a dormant creature, say like frogs going to hibernation during winter, then now there might be some external change happening, but they have the capacity to wake up. That capacity to wake up is within them. It is not something which has to be, some external stimulus may trigger them, but the capacity is within. So basically, does the soul have the capacity to love Krishna within it, or is the soul given the capacity to love Krishna? So that is the overall issue of debate. And that also relates with the fall of the jiva. It's a whole complicated thing. But the key point is that, at least in the way I understand or reconcile it, is that no material metaphor can precisely or exhaustively describe a spiritual reality. So, if we read Chaitanya Shikshamrita by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there he does, in some places, seem to echo what Prabhupada is saying. Some places can be read in different ways. But the broad point is, there is definitely something within the soul. In the Vedanta Sutra commented, the example is given that no matter how much what you do with stone, you're not going to get oil out of it. Isn't it? No matter what you do with stone. So, there has to be something intrinsic for oil to come out of it. You can use groundnut and then you crush it, you can get oil. You crush stone, no matter what you do, you're not going to get oil. So, there is definitely something within the soul. Without that, no matter, even if something is given from outside, nothing is going to happen. So, there is something within the soul. Now, what is the magnitude of what is innate within the soul? What is the magnitude of what comes from outside? That is something which is difficult to say. Because even when we say that, so some examples could be given of somebody just taking up to bhakti without any bhakti influence. Say, for example, when Bilwa Mangal Thakur started practicing bhakti, Chintamani just spoke one word. Was Chintamani a devotee? It seems she lived in a culture where she understood about God. But it is no mention that she was herself a practicing devotee. She had a particular profession which is not incompatible with devotion, but it's not exactly compatible so easily also. So, but in her case, it is said that her words triggered what Bilwa Mangal Thakur's guru had taught him in a previous life. So, even when somebody seems to be awakening bhakti in this lifetime without any guru's influence, it could be that it is from a previous life. It could be the innate potential in the soul. So, my understanding is this is not something which we need to get too much into. broadly speaking, there has to be some potentiality. And there is enough reference in scripture to support what Prabhupada says. Like the whole Bhaktivinoda Thakur song, Jiva Jago, Jiva Jago. And it's not just Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The idea of a dream and awake spiritual realization being like awakening from a dream. That is very much there in the Bhagavatam also. So, there is enough basis for what Prabhupada is saying. And then, what it means is that, now, Chakravarti Pad in his Madhuri Kadambani says that bhakti can be awakened in two ways. Swabhaviki and Balinutpadita. Swabhaviki means somebody has a natural attraction. Now, that means what? That it could be from previous life. It could be referring to the soul's natural attraction. Which has, but Balinutpadita is by a forceful association of a devotee. So that's what we are talking about, association. So, it could be, so I think there is room for both of those. The key point is that Prabhupada's explanation is very much defensible based on scripture. And in general, in the domains which are connected very much with the spiritual, it's a profoundly different domain. And it is very difficult to have the kind of certainty that we may have with respect to the domains that are more perceivable for us. So it's best to approach this with a certain degree of humility. Humility in this case would mean a certain level of comfort with uncertainty. That, you know, these are difficult things, and that humility as comfort with uncertainty is what is the foundation of Achintya Bheda Bhedi. That the ultimate reality is unknowable. So basically, devotion, or you can say strong devotion, we can see it in two ways. One is strong devotion means faith. And faith means certainty. This is what is right. And I have no doubts about it. I accept it. And anybody who doesn't accept it is a deviant. I was in Los Angeles and there was like a wall graffiti. And somebody had written, Jesus is the answer. And then next day somebody had come put a below another graffiti. But what is the question? So, you know, generally, when somebody gives the answer, when there is no question, it just becomes redundant. It doesn't really work. So, strong devotion can also, within the tradition itself, be seen as humility. If there is strong devotion, then we understand the greatness of God. And then that brings a profound amount of humility. And that humility will bring comfort with uncertainty. That there are realities far bigger than what I can perceive. And different people may have different perceptions of that reality. So we can live with it. This is the mood of 10.9 in the Gita when Krishna says, those who are Buddha, those who are enlightened, they bodhayantaha parasparam, they enlighten each other. If they are enlightened, why do they need to enlighten each other? Because the object of enlightenment is infinitely complex. And we can always keep learning more and more about Krishna. So that's why I think, with respect to these domains, that whatever way the spiritual awakening occurs, is it that somebody has, some devotee has to come in somebody's life, and without that it can't happen? Well, that is the normal way it will happen for most people. But can it not happen in some other way? Well, who are we to legislate that? So, if we see genuine bhakti, if it is a real authentic attraction towards the divine in someone who is not connected with the tradition, then we can say maybe it's from previous life, maybe it's dormant to the soul. And we are basically navigating into territory that is not comprehensible with certainty for the rational mind. So we adopt humility. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki cha, Tai Gaur Premanande. Thank you.